Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Remember this time last year?
Lindegroff, Panarin safe, rebound, score! Out of the netbound scramble, it's Duchesne, winning in double overtime.
Able to pitch around it. And Howie puts a charge into one, heading for the red seats. See you later.
Golden State ball and a technical foul. Paul Schizman thrown out of the game.
That will do it.
The return to glory. We will never see anything as exhilarating as that. Fantastic. Congratulations, Tiger. Unbelievable.
Man, it makes your heart just, because this year, yes, crickets. This year, crickets. Because April usually is the sports lover's Shangri-La. Baseball gearing up, hockey and basketball in the playoffs. Last year, golf fans were watching Tiger Woods win at the Masters. But this year, nothing. Again, just those crickets. So this hour on Point, we want to talk about how COVID-19 is changing all that we love in sports. And joining us to do that is Shira Springer. She is WBUR sports and society reporter, joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. Shira, it's great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you.
Okay. So I think that for many people in the United States, the first serious indication that this COVID-19 pandemic was big is when all of these sports leagues, the NBA in particular, suspended its season. And so now we've had many, many weeks of no professional sports whatsoever. For a sports lover, what has this been like?
Well, it's been tough because you sort of set the rhythms of your daily life to the sports calendar, right? You wait for the big game that you're looking forward to. And then the next day you look forward to talking to your friends and your family about what happened last night. So it sort of takes away a bonding experience, a communal experience. And that's sort of been the biggest loss. I mean, obviously the events are not taking place, but it's that community feel that you get from sports. You know, the ability to share something with someone else, you know, that you're watching the same thing or digesting something or criticizing the same thing.
Right. I mean, sports are a cultural force. There is no doubt about it. I mean, from the people who are like the diehard sports fan and follow every little moment, every game, every statistic of every player that's ever played for a particular team to, I'll be honest, folks like me who kind of have a casual relationship with professional sports. But the reason why I'm saying that, Shira, is in terms of a good measure of how powerful sports are as shaping our culture. You know, my kids, we live in Red Sox Nation. They've got Red Sox baseball caps. They know some of the team players, even though, like, I may not, but they do. And so it's just, it seems like such a profound loss to not have that touchstone taken away from everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you talk about talking with your kids about the Red Sox. You know, I regularly talk with my nephews about the Boston Bruins, and, you know, they were the points leader when the season was suspended. And, you know, there was all this chatter about, you know, amongst us, you know, will they win the Stanley Cup this year? And you miss that. I mean, that's the real loss here, the cultural loss, and the excitement and, you know, kind of the inspiration you get from athletes and the ability, you know, the getting to see something, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, we're watching a lot of these old games and it's like, okay, you know, they're interesting, they're fun to watch, but you know what's going to happen next. And what sports gives you is the unexpected also, the surprise, the you know, something great and historic might be right around the corner when you're watching the NBA playoffs or the NHL playoffs or the Masters. You know, you talk about Tiger and to not have that in your life is a real void.
And this is happening worldwide. I mean, this is totally unprecedented. We've been focusing on the United States, but I can imagine there are literally billions of soccer fans just like shivering, weeping heaps in the corner, not being able to watch their teams play at any level. And the other day I was thinking about like the multi-billion dollar industry of Indian cricket. I mean, there's an entire subcontinent there that's just like, what do we do? Because, I mean, the point that you're making is so important. That sports are this collective metaphor for life. So what is the metaphor saying right now, now that all of these games have stopped?
Well, I think it's that, you know, it's put sports in perspective. You know, it's made us pause and think and say there are things that are more important than sports that deserve greater priority than sports. And I think in some ways it's good that we sort of pulled back on our sports obsession just a little bit. That being said, you know, the Italian government just the other day was setting dates for when Italian soccer teams can return to play because, you know, not only is there this communal experience and this cultural experience, but it's a sense of normalcy that sports gives us too, right? That routine, the games you look forward to. I mean, a lot of people mark their yearly calendars by the sports season.
Yeah. And I actually think that's very important because if we are going to whatever world we land in on the other side of these pandemic curves, sports are going to be one of the great indicators of sort of who we are and how we live and what normal is. So I actually, you know, I think that governments ought to be thinking about this. But in terms of cultural leadership and the tone, cultural tone that sports sets, what kind of leadership have you been seeing, Shira, from leagues, from teams in the midst of this pandemic?
Well, I think you mentioned earlier what happened with the NBA and when Utah Jazz center Rudy Gobert tested positive. I believe it was on March 11th. And, you know, right away, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver shut the league down, suspended play. And that was, you know, that was leadership. That was saying to the country, really, we've got to take COVID-19 extremely seriously. And from that moment, there was a wave, not only of sports postponements and cancellations, you know, March Madness, the NCAA basketball tournaments were quickly canceled after that. And you saw a lot of other big sports events. But beyond that, that started a wave of school closures and that ultimately led to, you know, where we are now with shelter at home. And so I think you see how sports is such a visible part of our daily lives that when it stops, it makes us think, okay, this is something we need to take seriously. So there's the leadership from that standpoint, not playing, making sure the priorities are in the right place. You know, when Adam Silver, you know, also says, you know, when asked about return to play, it's about the data and not the date. He's sending another message that, hey, we have got to listen to the public health experts, the epidemiologists, when it comes to decisions about sports. This is not a decision that can be made in a vacuum. And I think that sends an important message, too. I will say that I am a little bit concerned now as we're hearing more and more talk about teams coming back. I mean, the NBA is planning, at least the latest reports say they're planning to open up practice facilities on May 1st. And I think you sports leagues have to be very careful, again, from that leadership perspective, because what they do, the optics communicates very loudly and clearly to the public about how seriously or perhaps not seriously they need to be taking shelter at home orders. So when you have players going back to practice facilities, what message does that send? And sports leagues and sports leaders and players, quite frankly, need to be thinking in those terms these days.
Well, we are talking this hour about COVID-19 and the entire world of sports, not just the big time professional leagues, but, you know, college, high school, even I'd say so your local pickup game, and how not having that central part of the collective human experience, what impact that's having. So sports fans out there, How have you been doing? What has life been like without an April calendar full of sporting events? Now, Shira, you mentioned about sort of stepping back a little bit from the primacy of sports in American life. I wanted to play a clip of the Notre Dame women's basketball coach, Muffet McGraw, who last week decided to retire after 33 years of leading the Fighting Irish.
I had made my decision after the season. You don't want to make a decision right after the season. So I was definitely leaning towards retiring. And then what happened during the pandemic was I had a great opportunity to pretend I was retired for a month with no one knowing it and deciding if I was going to be able to live with it or not. So
right.
I would say it reinforced my decision. And,
interesting.
You know, it was funny because I was like, wow, so this is what retirement's, although I will be able to at least leave the house when I'm retired.
That's Muffet McGraw on NPR's All Things Considered on Friday. Shira, tell us the story about her retirement.
Well, she retired after, you know, a legendary career at Notre Dame. And, you know, I think, you know, she spoke to it. It's, you get into this kind of routine of the grind of coaching college basketball, and you, it defines you, right? And it defined her. It certainly defined her in a, as I said, a legendary way. And you sometimes you get to the point where you think, well, can I really live without this as part, you know, as an essential part of my life? And I think she's experiencing something that a lot of sports leaders, coaches, general managers are experiencing on some level, whether they're retiring or not. I think one of the things that struck me just recently with the NFL draft, you kind of got to look into coaches' homes as you saw coaches with their families and their kids. And you heard a lot of comments afterwards about how this time is rare for them. And they're getting to, you know, sit down to dinner with their families, do homework with their kids. And it's been an interesting transition. And I think, again, perspective-inducing time for a lot of people whose lives have revolved around sports.
Well, we are talking this hour about what perspective that is, that this moment without sports worldwide is providing for all of us. So Shira Springer, hang on for just a moment. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on sports, because we've never been in a moment like this before on planet Earth, where basically no sports, team sports, are being played anywhere. And I'm joined today by Shira Springer. She is WBUR's sports and society reporter and also a contributing writer for the Boston Globe and Sports Business Journal as well. And joining us now from San Francisco is Bob Myers. He's president of basketball operations for the Golden State Warriors. Bob Myers, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. So first of all, just give us a snapshot. What has the past 6 weeks been like for you?
Like your previous mention of the Notre Dame coach, it's like a forced sabbatical, which we don't often get in this industry. It's you do get to take stock of your life. I told somebody that it feels like we were going 100 miles an hour, and then you're stopped. You pull the emergency brake on the season, and it's, look, for me personally, it's been okay, because we were on this 5-year kind of pedal to the metal run with our team, and our whole season was kind of fraught with ups and downs. And so for me personally, it's a time to breathe, but everybody experiences, I heard you say you're not the biggest sports fan. I have three daughters. My wife is probably more inclined to view it the way you do, but everybody has a different vantage point to sports. But I will say, and I agree with both of you and Shira, that it has a huge place in our minds and hearts globally. So it's a question you could ask everybody and maybe get a different answer from everybody.
So Bob, let me just jump in here because I know I am going to get an avalanche of emails about this. I just want to clarify. I played sports passionately, specifically soccer and basketball, actually, middle school and high school. Several knee surgeries later, that era of my life is over. I just don't consider myself the kind of deeply knowledgeable fan who really does, as Shira was talking about, it's like a central part of how I measure the passage of time or where I find meaning at this point in time. So I just can't compare myself to those true blue fans out there who really live and breathe this stuff. The only exception I'll make is for World Cup soccer for women's and men's. Because I will ride that crazy wave every couple of years. But don't write me emails, folks, about how like out of touch I am that I'm not an obsessed sport fan. Okay, I get it. But Bob, let me turn back to you because you heard how Shira was talking earlier about the leadership. I mean, because of the cultural importance that sports plays in our lives, about the leadership that leagues and teams can also show at this moment in time. Are you seeing the opportunity for that? Is Golden State doing things on that front to stay as sort of an example for other people?
We try, Meg. We try, like everybody else tries, like you try, like Shira tries. We all try to lead if we have the opportunity to lead or speak. One of the things that I found interesting was I was at San Quentin prison speaking at a panel one time with some 49ers, and this was in the height of the kind of Kaepernick era of what he was doing and standing for. And a professor from Berkeley, who you may know as you were probably Pac-12, I was Pac-10 when I was in college, but he's a professor, I think sociology at Berkeley, and he was speaking at a panel, and he said he was speaking to a group of kids and he asked them, who would you rather be, President Obama, Steph Curry, or LeBron James? And all the hands went up for Curry and LeBron. And so why is that relevant? Kids are listening to these athletes almost more than anybody. Whether that's right or wrong, let's just put that aside for now. But it's true. And so Steph Curry getting on a Zoom call with Dr. Fauci is a huge thing, and we're lucky to have a guy like him in our organization that takes a lead as far as things like this socially, his awareness, his giving back to the community. Steve Kerr has been brilliant with what he's done, not just in this level, but what he speaks on behalf of. So we try. We're in an interesting place, not unlike Boston. I mean, we're pretty cutting edge. We're very open minded. We speak our mind organizationally, and so we hope we fit that bill. But the beauty of sports and the beauty of anything in our country is you get to say what you want and you get to listen to who you want. And so sports provides, like you said, a platform for that. But with that platform comes a responsibility. And we hope we stay responsible when we speak on something like this.
Yeah. And just FYI, when I graduated from Oregon State, it was still in the Pac-10. So Shira, jump in here. I mean, what are you hearing about the potential for leadership, even if athletes aren't on the court or on the field?
Well, I think the Steph Curry, Anthony Fauci conversation is a prime example of what athletes can do. I think, you know, they can make sure that the public, particularly that younger demographic, kids, have the right information, have good information, that they have the best facts available. I also think back to a member, Marcus Smart, who tested positive for COVID-19. And just in the process of announcing his positive test, he basically said, hey, you know, take care of yourself, wash your hands. You know, you need to do X, Y, and Z to keep yourself healthy. And then, you know, later on, he donated, he's donating plasma to the plasma, I think it's convalescent project. And so they can lead in that way too, by keeping the public informed and by, you know, publicizing, you know, using their platform to publicize things like plasma donation.
Mm. Well, you know, I actually want to take a moment to be transparent about something, because Bob is joining us today and we're very, very glad to have him. I mean, it's not every day we get the president of basketball operations for the Warriors, but the NBA is not letting people talk about the financial ramifications of the pandemic on the league or from speculating on a timeline about when and if and when the season will start again. The NBA is not letting, you know, people associated with it to talk about those things. But Shira, you are a reporter, so let me turn those questions to you. Do we have any sense? I mean, look, we cannot avoid the fact that sports are multi-billion dollar businesses as well. What's the impact here of not being able to play, of not having fans in the seats?
Well, you say multi-billion dollar businesses. The impact is the loss of billions, clearly. To the question of do we know when games might come back, I think the latest is the opening of team facilities, which may take place as early as May 1st. But to be clear, only in those locations where shelter-at-home restrictions have been eased. And I guess, and I'm hoping, it raises in my mind, just, you know, when we're looking at a timeline here, you know, the players haven't played since early March, March 11th. What is the buildup, the training, the conditioning? I mean, how long even is that going to take before players can sort of feel comfortable, and that simply from an injury standpoint, that they're ready to go back on the court and play, you know, at full speed?
Yeah, I think I defer to Chris Paul, who's, I believe, the president of the NBA Players Union, mentioning a few weeks, 3 to 4, and I don't want to speak for players. I was nowhere near an NBA athlete, but I do know it's very hard to get back in shape after some time off. So it'll be interesting. I do think that to your question, Meg, and to your response, Shira, it's the beauty of the NBA, and I'm proud to work within it, is our commissioner, Adam Silver, has been a great leader, has been a leader that has had an ability to stay on the pulse of society and what's right and what's fair. And he will, I believe, lead us in the right direction here. And it will focus, if you hear him speak, it's about health. It's about the health of our fans, the health of our players, whether that means how much time they need to play, and whether that means keeping them safe in whatever path we choose. But this is a health issue, really. And it's a government issue, and there's many layers to it. So we're going to follow that lead and do the best we can. The why there's so much conversation around all these things, whether it's opening businesses or sports, is there's a lot of different viewpoints in a very uncertain time. And so sports has its place in that. And we're trying to be leaders, like you mentioned, Meg, and do our best. But this is something where you're even seeing politicians struggle with the right answer. What is the right answer? And I think you see a lot of imperfect answers. And that's the challenge of this.
Yeah. So,
yeah, Meghna, if I could jump in here with one thing, Meghna. I think I'd even go one better with Adam Silver and his leadership, Bob. I think what he did in, you know, suspending at the NBA right after the Gobert positive test saved lives. I mean, I don't think there's any question that his leadership and his quick decision making saved lives.
Yeah. And I haven't heard it said that way, but I'm not going to argue with that. I think I don't think that's anything overly dramatic. I really don't believe that's because that was he even mentioned on the last time we did a call with the general managers that we were the first league to kind of pull the plug, and it was abruptly done. And it was the cold splash on the water, a face of society. You talk about sports place. That was the kind of, wait a second here. And I'm not saying this because I work in the business. You two can respond, Meg. Hopefully I won't rip on your sports awareness anymore, but I think you probably saw that part. I think it was all of a sudden for society, whether you like sports or not, or follow the NBA, it was kind of, wait a second, this is serious here. The NBA just suspended their season. And Adam did it quickly. He did it forcefully. And I think it was a moment, at least in our country, where everybody said, we got to pay attention now to what's going on in our communities, in our country.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, that's exactly why we're having this conversation today. I completely agree with you, because sports are so central. They're so culturally powerful that when a big, important league like the NBA says, nope, this is actually bigger than us, and we're going to pause, I think for tens of millions of Americans, that was the moment that they thought to themselves, okay, I need to start paying attention to. No doubt whatsoever. But let's go to some of those folks. Let's go to Teddy, who's calling from Parks in Maryland. Teddy, you're on the air.
Yeah, Megan, I will tell you, I am a sports fan. Oh, my goodness. NCAA basketball, Major League Baseball, love it. NFL football, love it. But it's interesting because your guest just opened my eyes to something that I had not thought about heretofore, which is it affects people who are playing cricket professionally. People who are playing soccer. And so we're not just talking about the U.S. We're talking about sports all over this, literally all over this world. So I appreciate her for opening my eyes and making me see that, wow, it's way bigger than just Major League Baseball, yeah, or NCAA, yeah, basketball or anything like that. I really appreciate her for saying that.
Well, so Teddy, look, normally I wouldn't actually like toot my own horn about this, but the least sports savvy person at this table is the one who pointed out cricket and soccer. So I'm just saying, Teddy, how are you getting by? I mean, Teddy, since you're a true lover of sports, like, are you watching old games? Like, what are you doing to fill the void?
I am watching the reruns of the playoffs from years ago, even regular season games. And I'll tell you what keeps me going. What keeps me going is when they replay these games, no matter whether it's playoffs, division battles, whatever the case may be, when they play these games, I realize this, they're playing the absolute best games. They're not playing blowouts. They're not playing long drag-out games. They're talking about games that are won at the last second, mm-hmm, with the last shot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it excites me. And guess what? A lot of these games, I don't even remember. So I'm intrigued, and it holds my attention until the clock says zero.
Yeah. Well, Teddy, thank you so much for your call. Thank you. From Teddy, this Teddy from Parks in Maryland. Shira, you're watching old games too? I feel like a lot of people are doing that.
Yeah, watching some old games. Also captivated by the Michael Jordan documentary, just because it's fresh content, The Last Dance on ESPN. Actually, also revisiting some old sports stories, some good narrative sports stories, to kind of relive those moments too. I think it's interesting, you know, one of the questions that I have, and we'll talk to another fan, but, you know, Teddy was so passionate about, you know, his fandom. I wonder, you know, on the other side of this, you know, how many fans or how soon fans are going to be willing to come back into crowded arenas. I think that's something also to keep an eye on.
Mm, I think it's a really important question. And Bob, let me turn a version of that to you. I'm not going to ask you when you think the NBA is going to restart here, but eventually it will. And we might see sort of an interim period where players are playing in empty arenas, for example. I just wonder if you're willing to sort of conjecture a little bit about how this pandemic kind of might change what we see when players get back on the court.
Yeah, I think it's our job, Meg, to make it feel safe. Maya Angelou's got a great quote. People forget what you said, forget what you did, but they won't forget how you made them feel. We have to make fans feel safe. That's the most important thing. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. I Adam Silver, again, used the analogy, which I think is an appropriate one, of 9/11, when post 9/11, I can't walk my wife to the gate. I can't pick up my daughter or my parents at the gate. And there was an adjustment period where, what do you mean I got to take my shoes off? Wait, hang on. I got to take my laptop out of my back. Why? Wait a sec. What's this line so long? For the first couple of years, you'd sit on the plane and look, I looked around. I looked around who's sitting next to me. It's not fair. It's not right. But you were on this kind of edge of your seat, had this trepidation about flying. And everybody experienced that differently. Over time, it eased. And I don't even think about that stuff anymore. Depends on who you are, how long that adjustment takes. But it's our job as a league, and any league, and this goes for restaurants, movie theaters, any place you're interacting with people, we're all going to have to feel safe, because the experience isn't the same when it's on your mind if you're feeling not safe and you're feeling afraid. And so that's what we have to do. And I think we will. And I think it'll take some time, and we've got tremendous people working on it. Like I said, our league is a leader in that. And to the point of the caller, and also what Shear said and what you're saying, Meg, is I think the thing that sports personifies is it's a connector. And that, and fans experience that too. We talk about the weather. Sometimes you'll bring up the weather when you're talking to a stranger, and you'll even inside yourself, you're thinking, what am I doing? Why am I asking about the weather? Who cares? The same as with sports. If I'm in Boston and somebody brings up the Red Sox or the Celtics, it's an immediate connection. And in life, that's what we're looking for, is connections. And sports is an obvious one. It doesn't have to be a particular sport, but it connects us all. And I think that's what people are missing.
Well, Bob Myers, president of basketball operations for the Golden State Warriors, joining us today from San Francisco. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be taking a look at urban design and whether we can create cities that actually promote human health. We'll be talking to an urban planner and an architect, and we're wondering what changes you'd like to see in the short, medium, and long run in terms of how cities are designed. Leave us a voicemail with your ideas at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And imagine with us a future where cities can actually promote public health. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about our current world, which is one without sports, and the impact that's having, not just on the leagues and the athletes that play the sports, but on the fans as well, and on us all, as sports are such an important sort of cultural touchstone. I'm joined today by Shira Springer. She is WBUR sports and society reporter. And Shira, before the break, we talked a lot about the NBA. I want to just focus a loop for a minute or two on the NFL, the other huge, very huge league in the United States, because we mentioned the draft. This was the first time this year that the NFL draft was all virtual, and a record-shattering 55 million people tuned in to the NFL draft this past weekend. That's up more than 30% from last year. And here's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell.
We will get through this together. And when we do, we will be here for you. As we celebrate the newest class of the NFL, we hope the draft will provide a break from everyday challenges. Let us dream of better days and help others.
That's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Well, On Point listener Jan from Frederick, Maryland, left us this voicemail about the value of the draft this year.
I'm a huge sports fan. I felt it was very important for the NFL draft to go on as scheduled. It gave us something to kind of look forward to, give us something of a sense of normalcy.
That's Jan from Frederick, Maryland. On Point listener Keith from Point Pleasant, New Jersey, had a different view.
I was done with football well before our current pandemic, and I almost hope the sport goes away. But I do miss baseball. That is, you know, that's a sport that truly represents America, and I'm looking forward to that returning.
That's On Point listener Keith from Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Shira, What do you hear in those two very different takes from fans about the NFL at this moment in the middle of the pandemic?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think the NFL is kind of, you know, there's a bit of a love-hate relationship with the public because of, you know, concussions and off-field issues and domestic violence. And so it's been a rough go for the NFL. But I do, you know, you mentioned the record numbers for the draft. I do think that speaks to something that's a little bit beyond the NFL. In addition to the virtual WNBA draft, the NFL draft was the first sort of live, fresh, if you can call it, sports content the U.S. has had in weeks, you know, since early March. And, you know, it's also the one season that hasn't yet been interrupted. Mm-hmm. So I know now there's talk that, you know, the regular season could start as late as October 15th and a Super Bowl that would be at the end of February, not at the beginning of February. But going back to the actual draft, what I actually loved about this draft, usually it's this over the top sort of party and the players come up on stage with, you know, Roger Goodell, and it was going to be held in Vegas this year. And I think there was some plan to like sail the put the players in boats that sailed across the Bellagio fountain. I mean, you know, crazy over the top stuff. But instead, what you got was this look into the homes of players, of coaches and GMs, as I mentioned before. And it was just a much more intimate feel. And it was fun and it was different. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if the NFL keeps some of the virtual aspects of the draft in the future, because I learned a lot about coaches and GMs from watching, you know, getting up to peek inside their homes. I mean, it was fun. It was different. It was fresh.
Yeah. You probably learned a lot of them are getting paid a lot of money.
Some of those houses could be movie sets, man.
Are the Bellagio fountain really? Okay, I'm gonna put that aside for right now. But it does sound as if you're saying there's an opportunity to actually maybe kind of slightly redefine fandom and actually and bring fans and players at least kind of closer together through this.
Absolutely. I think that's one thing that will emerge out of the pandemic is that redefinition of the fan experience. It's going to look different for a long time, you know, once fans are allowed to come back into stadiums, first of all. But also in the interim, leagues and teams are finding new ways to engage and connect with fans, you know, through technology. Sometimes, you know, that's giving them access to old footage. Sometimes that's holding Zoom town halls with players. But I think what will emerge from this is a more intimate relationship between fans and players through technology. There'll be an expectation that you might get a star player to talk to a bunch of season ticket holders via Zoom. And that will be part of the programming from here on out. And there will be an expectation that the NFL draft and other drafts will take you inside the homes of draftees and coaches and GMs. And again, a more intimate view of the sports world will emerge from this.
Well, I want to hear the voice of an athlete now. And joining us is Molly Seidel. She's a long distance runner. And on February 29th, she placed second in the U.S. Marathon Olympic trials. And of course, not long after that, the 2020 Summer Games were postponed. But Molly joins us now. Welcome to the program, Molly.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, despite there being no Summer Games in Tokyo this summer, I still want to say congratulations on your qualification for the U.S. Olympic team in the marathon. How have you been the past, month and a half?
It's definitely been a strange time, I think, for everyone. It has been, and just with kind of the roller coaster that it's been from qualifying for the team at the end of February to then the games being postponed, it's really kind of the highest of highs and lowest of lows at this point.
Yeah. And especially for something like the Olympic Games, I mean, has this completely blown out of the water? Obviously, the kind of training that you had to do, the way your whole life was sort of organized around preparing for this pinnacle event that was supposed to happen this summer.
Yeah, it's definitely difficult because for our sport specifically, we're on this 4-year cycle, whereas with the NFL and the NBA, they're doing it every year. People only really focus on our sport every 4 years. And so you plan and you train and you get ready for this massive event that's coming, and you've put 4 years of your life into it, and then all of a sudden it's up in the air whether or not it's actually going to happen. So I think there's definitely a relief for a lot of us Olympic athletes that it's postponed rather than canceled, and trying to look at the positives of the situation rather than to just dwell on the negatives that it's going to be pushed back here.
Yeah. And do you mind if I ask you, I mean, your qualification on February 29th, first of all, it's amazing for any athlete to qualify for the U.S. Olympic team, but you also personally came through a lot of challenges to get to this place. Now, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So basically I've been running since high school, ran in college at University of Notre Dame, where I won several NCAA championships, but I really struggled with mental health, eating disorders. And basically in 2016, when I tried to qualify for the team, my senior year of college, I was in such an unhealthy place that I basically got injured before I even made it to the line there. So the past 4 years, I've really been focusing on trying to get myself as healthy mentally and physically as I could so that I didn't make those same mistakes this time around. And when I stepped to the line on February 29th for the Marathon Olympic trials, I really felt like I was finally in a place where I was going to be able to race to my full potential. And the day kind of just worked out like I couldn't have even imagined. Everything just clicked, and truly it was one of the greatest days of my life. And it almost seems like a million years ago at this point now, or at the very least, a completely different world that we were racing in, because right after that, basically the whole world shut down.
Yeah. And do you see your running life, your competitive running life, getting back to normal anytime soon?
Truthfully, no. Right now, my coach and I have been talking about how we train as best we can during this. I am very lucky in the sense that I can kind of train anywhere in the world. It's not a sport like swimming where you're restricted to a pool. I can train on the roads. I can train on the Charles River Path in Boston. And it's more just the uncertainty of not knowing when races are going to start up again. That's where kind of the bulk of our income as professional athletes come from. And even now, I can't even plan on potentially doing a marathon in the fall like Boston or New York, because we frankly don't know whether or not they're going to happen.
Right. Well, Shira Springer, I'm going to bring you back in here because of your many talents. Being a long distance runner is also one of them, Shira. Usually Shira's running the Boston Marathon and I'm at mile 24 cheering with my open beer can as she blasts by. But Shira, I mean, talk to me about what you're hearing in Molly's story and even, you know, for Olympic athletes in general, because as Molly pointed out, it's a different timeline that they're training on, which has been very powerfully disrupted.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, as Molly mentioned, it's you get your shot once every 4 years, and everything is poured into this 4-year training plan. And, you know, we think of it, oh, it's just a year postponement, but that year, going through training cycles over another year is tough. I know it's going to be tough for Molly. I know it's going to be tough, particularly for those athletes who haven't qualified. They're sort of in limbo now for another year, trying to figure out their plans, because Olympic athletes really do put their lives on hold, when they're training for the games. And I think the other issue, you know, that's sort of unique to Molly's situation as a marathon runner is, the Olympic trials, you didn't mention this, Molly, was your first full-length marathon. Talking to Molly, you'd like to race another marathon, but you don't know when that's going to be. And as somebody who's a recreational marathoner, if that's such a term, you know, I think marathons are going to be, you know, mass marathons with large crowds of runners, 30,000 plus, like the Boston Marathon, are going to be some of the last major sports events to return simply because of the logistics and all the people crowded in there. I think it's an event you can't hold until you have a vaccine.
Mm. Molly, what do you think about that?
Yes, that's been among the discussions, is that just the logistics of a marathon with all of these people packed together, it's very difficult to control any sort of virus containment at those events. So there have been ideas floated about some of these big city marathons of just doing pro fields in them, like they did in the Tokyo Marathon this past spring when the virus had already hit in Japan. So I think there's lots of different options. And it's trying to figure out how we conduct sports in kind of the new world that we're facing, because it's probably not going to go back to the way that it was, at the very least, for a very long time.
Well, Molly Seidel, regardless of when the Olympics do happen, we look forward to seeing you at the line running for the United States. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Shira, I want to squeeze in one or two more callers here before we're flat out of time. So let's go to Adam, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Adam, you're on the air.
Thanks, Meghna. My question is specifically about baseball. I've been a baseball fan my whole life. I'm 41 now. And my favorite part is calling my dad two or three times during every Red Sox game to vent to each other or celebrate. And baseball right now, you know, I feel like ratings have slipped, and now people associate the sport with the Astros cheating scandal, and momentum is low. So is there a way to safely bring baseball back? Because I feel like people are so hungry for sports, and baseball showed some leadership and maybe came back first, that it could bring in some new fans.
Yeah. Adam, great question. Shira, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, Major League Baseball's commissioner, Rob Manfred, has, you know, it's been floating different ideas out there. You know, some of the ideas that I've heard and that have been reported have been, you know, playing all the games, you know, moving the teams to Arizona, playing all the games in Arizona in a bubble, or, you know, spreading teams out between Florida, Texas, and Arizona, or maybe it's a Florida-Arizona league. But all of that talk seems a bit premature, because I think when we talk about playing these games in a bubble, we have to also talk about all, it's not just the teams that are affected. There's a lot of support staff and broadcasters and a lot of people that would be involved, a lot of testing resources. So those types of plans need to be carefully vetted. And as good as it might be for baseball to be first out of the gates, it's also a really risky proposition.
Yeah.
Because if something goes wrong, when you start up again, that's particularly problematic for a sport like baseball, which the caller mentioned has been struggling to win over fans and has been tarnished by a sign stealing scandal.
Yeah.
So lots to think about for baseball.
Sure. We have less than a minute to go. And there's one last thought I want to leave you with, that even though I'm not the kind of person who knows what the batting average is of some player from the 1921 World Red Sox, or like how many shots on goal Messi took last year, I don't know that kind of stuff. I will still argue, though, that I think coming out of this, sports may become even more important for all of us, because that human desire to play, and that sports will be one of the biggest things that signals not a return, but maybe a sense that this is a world we're familiar with and people are yearning for that. So I actually look forward to that.
Yeah, sports is going to be one of the big players, so to speak, in defining our new normal. And it's going to lead in that way.
Well, Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Shira, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope you're doing well, by the way. I haven't seen you in a while, so I hope you're doing really well.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.